What we're going to do today is chapters 22 and 23, and I didn't produce notes because there wasn't a lot that was notable, because this is all I need.
That's all I need, too.
And so these are the notes from the preceding weeks.
Yes.
Anybody need notes?
Anybody need notes from preceding weeks?
We do.
Yeah, just pass them around. And, of course, remember, week before last, there weren't any notes either, because I didn't even need a postcard. Yeah, I didn't even need a postcard that day. Because this is a sort of a, it's, in a way, it's a straightforward story. But in another way, a lot's going on here theologically. And, you know, on the surface, it's kind of man on the run, and King loses his mind. But at another level, what we see is Yahweh's hand moving strongly in David's rise and in Saul's decline. And the contradiction between the two is a demonstration of the worst of what the kingship can be, but also the best of what it can and will become. And unfortunately, though, in David, the best it ever will be. So we'll start by reading the texts. And here we go, chapter 22, 1 Samuel. David left there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and all his father's house heard of it, they went down there to him, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Those who were with him numbered about 400. David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. He said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come to you until I know what God will do for me." He left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Then the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Leave and go into the land of Judah." So David left and went to the forest of Hereth. Saul heard that David and those who were with him had been located. Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him. Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, you Benjaminites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a league with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as he is doing today." Doeg the Edomite, who is in charge of Saul's servants, answered, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Hattub. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. The king sent for the priest Ahimelech, the son of Hattub, and for all his father's house, the priests who are at Nob, and all of them came to the king. Saul said, 'Listen now, son of Hattub.' He answered, 'Here I am, my lord.' Saul said to him, 'Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, by giving him bread and a sword, and by inquiring of God for him, so that he has risen up against me to lie in wait as he is doing today?' Then Ahimelech answered the king, 'Who among all your servants is so faithful as David? He is the king's son-in-law and is quick to do your bidding and is honored in your house. Is today the first time that I have inquired of God for him? By no means. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any member of my father's house, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little.' The king said, 'You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house.' The king said to the guard who stood around him, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David. They knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me.' But the servants of the king would not raise their hand to attack the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, 'You, Doeg, turn and attack the priests.' Doeg the Edomite turned and attacked the priests. On that day he killed 85 who wore the linen ephod. Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword. Men and women, children and infants, oxen, donkeys, and sheep, he put to the sword. But one of the sons of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. David said to Abiathar, "I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, 'I am responsible for the lives of all your father's house. Stay with me and do not be afraid, for the one who seeks my life seeks your life. You will be safe with me.'" Now they told David, "The Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are robbing the threshing floors." David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" The Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines and save Keilah." But David's men said to him, "Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" Then David inquired of the Lord again. The Lord answered him, "Yes, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hand." So David and his men went to Keilah, fought with the Philistines, brought away their livestock, and dealt them a heavy defeat. Thus David rescued the inhabitants of Keilah. When Abiathar, son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, he came down with an ephod in his hand. Now it was told Saul that David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, "God has given him into my hand, for he has shut himself in by entering a town that has gates and bars." Saul summoned all the people to war, to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. When David learned that Saul was plotting evil against him, he said to the priest Abiathar, "Bring the ephod here." David said, "O Lord, the God of Israel, your servant has heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. And now will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord, the God of Israel, I beseech you, tell your servant." The Lord said, "He will come down." Then David said, "Will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul?" The Lord said, "They will surrender you." Then David and his men, who were about 600, set out and left Keilah. They wandered wherever they could go. When Saul was told that David had escaped from Keilah, he gave up the expedition. David remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but the Lord did not give him into his hand. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh when he learned that Saul had come out to seek his life. Saul's son Jonathan set out and came to David at Horesh. There he strengthened his hand through the Lord. He said to him, "Do not be afraid, for the hand of my father Saul shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be second to you. My father Saul also knows that this is so." Then the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. Then some Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah and said, "David is hiding among us in the strongholds of Horesh on the hill of Hachalah, which is south of Jeshimon. Now, O king, whenever you wish to come down, do so, and our part will be to surrender him into the king's hand." Saul said, "May you be blessed by the Lord for showing me compassion. Go and make sure once more, find out exactly where he is and who has seen him there, for I am told that he is very cunning. Look around and learn all the hiding places where he lurks, and come back to me with sure information. Then I will go out with you, and if he is in the land, I will search him out among all the thousands of Judah." So they set out and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon, in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. Saul and his men went to search for him. David was told he went down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. When Saul heard that, he pursued David into the wilderness of Maon. Saul went on one side of the mountain and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. David was hurrying to get away from Saul, while Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture them. Then a messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid on the land." So Saul stopped pursuing David and went against the Philistines. Therefore that place was called the Rock of Escape. David then went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay. So David clears out of Gath when he's aware that they recognize who he is. As you remember from last week, at the very end of chapter 21, he acts like a crazy person, and the king's like, well, I got plenty of those. Get this guy out of here. So he goes to Adullam. His family gathers around him, and not just them, but everybody with resentments, the have-nots, the people whom Saul had kind of neglected. He had enriched his court, but as we know from way back when the people were clamoring for a king, God warned them through the prophet Samuel, this is a bad idea, because this is what the king is going to do to you. He's going to conscript your sons. He's going to take away portions of your flocks and herds and your harvest. And so these are the losers in the monarchy, and they gather around David, about 400 of them, although later it says 600, and you know, maybe between here and there he gets more, but again, there's a degree of confusion in the most ancient manuscripts. He goes over to the king of Moab, which is kind of odd, and he wants protection for his parents. And the king agrees. And one sort of wonders why. And to understand, you have to dip into the book of Ruth. In chapter 4, verses 13 through 22, we learn that Ruth is David's great-grandmother, and she was part Moabite. And so that's why he would have had a legitimate claim to ask his parents to receive sanctuary from him. After this, a prophet named Gad, very obscure, his name only appears in a few other places, warns David that he's got to clear off. And so he goes into the forest of Hereth. We have no idea where that is. Here's where David is, and he's at his headquarters in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree with a spear in his hand, as usual. And he's got all of his servants around him, and he really lays into them. He's like, you have all betrayed me. I've done everything for you. I've made you rich. I've made you powerful. I've given you prestige. And you just let me down. Nobody tells me where David is. Nobody tells me what my son Jonathan's up to, trying to promote his cause. And, so his paranoia is just clinical at this point. Doeg, which I think is a marvelously onomatopoetic name for this person, Doeg, who's in charge of Saul's servants, so this is definitely a case where the butler did it. Doeg said, oh, well, I saw Jesse over in Nob. You'll remember that he was kind of lurking around. And Ahimelech, the priest, gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath and sort of did some divination for him with God. Now, when David encountered Abiathar, there's no mention there that he did the divination. The other two, yeah, he gave him food to eat and he gave him the sword of Goliath. So the king sends for Ahimelech and accuses him of the same thing that he accused the servants of. And Ahimelech makes a marvelous defense. He would have made a good trial attorney because what he's doing is he's protecting David to protect himself. Because if David's innocent, then how can Ahimelech have done anything wrong? He says, David is the most faithful of all your servants. He's your son-in-law. You let him marry your daughter. And, it's not like this is the first time I asked some questions for him to God. And don't lay into me. I don't know where the guy comes. I mean, he shows up, he goes someplace else. He doesn't leave a forwarding address. Saul's not buying any of this. You're a dead man, all of you. And so he goes and he says to his guards, kill him. And they're not going to do it because they're priests of Yahweh. I mean, that would have been an intensely sacrilegious thing. Fortunately, there's a foreigner there, an Edomite named Doeg. And since he's a foreigner, one would reasonably assume that he was not someone who is considered to be part of the covenant people, that he was not someone who perhaps even was a worshiper of Yahweh. So he's got no problem killing the priests, and he slaughters 85 of them. And he goes even beyond Saul's instructions, because then he goes to Nob, where they live, and he kills everybody, and he kills all the animals. But one escapes, Abiathar, and he finds David. He seeks sanctuary with David, tells him what happens. And David, you know, in a stark contradiction to Saul and his bloodthirstiness and his complete absence of responsibility. I mean, he is victim number one. You know, all of you have betrayed me. You never tell me where David is. You don't keep me caught up with what my son Jonathan's coming up to. So a man takes no responsibility for anything, and he's the king. And David says, oh, I knew that Doeg was there that day. This is my fault. All these people are dead because of me, because I was hungry and because I needed a weapon. I feel awful. So, yeah, stay with me, Abiathar. We have a common enemy. Saul's trying to kill us both, and I'll keep you safe. You know, and this fulfills, in large part, a prophecy that we saw all the way back in chapter 2, in verses 31 through 36, where God's not terribly happy with Eli's sons. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And so what he says is that your entire house of priests will be wiped out except for one. There will be one survivor, and then you'll be replaced. So Abiathar is the one survivor. He is, if I remember correctly, Eli's grandson, or maybe great-grandson, but I'm pretty sure it's grandson. And then we'll see later in 1 Kings that Abiathar, because he backs the wrong horse in the succession race, he's going to be replaced by Zadok, who was Solomon's favorite to be king. So this prophecy of condemnation gets played out over the course of three kingships, Saul, then David, and then eventually Solomon. So this is part two, where Abiathar is the remaining survivor. So they come to David and say, the Philistines are fighting at Keilah. And this appears to be sort of a border city. It could have been in Philistine territory. It could have been on the border between Philistine and Judah. It might have been an independent city that didn't really belong to both. And so David asks God, well, should I go and attack them? And this starts a pattern we're going to see consistently repeated through chapter 23. The temptation is to see David as kind of a man of action, when in fact he is a man of prayer. He's constantly seeking God's guidance to find out what he should do. And I'm not saying that prayer is not action, but when we think man of action, we think of, like, I don't know, Matt Damon in the Bourne trilogy and stuff like that. But David here is portrayed principally as a man of prayer, and it's then the prayer that propels him into battle. It's prayer that rescues him from the schemes of Saul. And so God said, yeah, go. And his men are like, you know, we're scared enough already, and you want us to go up against the Philistines. And he said, and so David goes back again. He says, well, should I do this? He said, yeah. Don't worry, you're going to beat the Philistines. So they go, they fight, they win, they rescue the people in Keilah. So as we've been seeing, the favor of David building among the populace, the support that he's getting from all the big power brokers, from Samuel the prophet and the other prophets, from the priesthood, and even from foreign rulers, it's just building up, and so this is another feather in his cap. So they're down at Keilah, and Abiathar, of course, is a priest, has an ephod, which is a priestly garment that we read a lot about when we studied Exodus last year. And this ephod will play a role shortly. Saul is informed that where David is, and he's like, excellent. This is a fortified city. He's shut up in there. He's trapped. And David finds out that Saul's coming, and so he says, okay, Abiathar, it's time to whip out the ephod again. And presumably, this is an ephod that contains those two stones, white and black, that we've talked about so much before, the Urim and the Thummim. And these were basically tools of divination. They were yes-no. Where presumably white was yes, black was no, but we don't really know. Because we're not even sure if they were white and black, but that makes sense. And that was the tradition that was carried on straight through to the end of the temple priesthood in the time of Jesus and immediately afterwards. And so he wants to know, is Saul really coming? God says, yep. And then David says, so are the people of the city going to hand me over to Saul? And God says, sure will. And so they clear off. They're up to 600 now from 400 at the beginning of chapter 22. And they are just sort of wandering around, helter-skelter, just trying to get away from Saul, really. And Saul's like, okay, they're not in sin anymore. I give up. He goes up to the wilderness of Ziph, which is in the hill country of Judea, or Judah, sorry, it's not Judea yet. And Saul keeps chasing him, even though it says like a verse and a half before that he gave up. He's at Horesh, where's Horeth? I'm going to use my cheat sheet. I didn't write it down, so I don't know where it is. So he's in Horesh, and Jonathan comes to him, and sort of they renew their covenant with one another, this solemn covenant, and he says, Saul can't find you, you're going to be king, and I'm going to be your XO. This is the clearest indication we've gotten from Jonathan yet. I mean, it's very explicit. I'm the heir to the throne, but I'm giving it over to you, and I'd be perfectly content to be your helper. And Saul knows this is so. And Saul certainly has his suspicions, and shortly he himself will articulate the fact that he knows that David's going to be taking over from him. Jonathan goes home, and some Ziphites go up to Saul at his headquarters in Gibeah and say, hey, we know where he is. He's near Hachalah, south of Jeshimon. We have no clue where those places are. We'll help you out. And Saul says, may you be blessed by the Lord for showing me compassion. I mean, what a pitiful guy. I feel sorry for him, which is what he wants. And so I feel bad for feeling sorry for him. But, I mean, he's pathetic. He's just pathetic. And he says, do some scouting. I want to know exactly where he is this time. Because he's a tricky fella. And, suss out all the good hiding places, and then I'll go with you and we'll wipe him out. So they do that, and David and his men find this out while they're in this wilderness around Maon, which is about 8 miles south of Hebron. We actually do know where that is. In a repeating theme, Saul goes to hunt him down. David finds out he's got a pretty good information network, which isn't surprising considering that basically everybody's on his side by now. They end up chasing one another around this mountain. It reminds me of the Shenandoah Valley campaigns of the Civil War. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but there was a campaign, and I'm sorry I can't remember which one, where the Confederate forces and the Union forces were on different sides of this mountain range. And they were basically racing to reach this pass in between two mountain ranges, because basically whoever got there would have the advantageous position, obviously, to do battle in these sort of set-piece fights that you have in the Civil War in that era. It's kind of comical, but really tense. And Saul breaks off the pursuit only when a messenger comes and he says, hey, the Philistines are causing trouble again. And he's the king. He's got to take care of that, because protecting people against the Philistines was basically his number one job. And if he didn't get that done, then ball game over. So he breaks off his pursuit, goes after the Philistines, and it's called the Rock of Escape. You also may have a footnote, as I do in my study Bible, that it's called the Rock of Division. And in both commentaries I read, they see that as the more legitimate reading. Then David goes from there to the strongholds of En-Gedi, and we will resume this adventure next week when we jump into chapters 24 through 25. And believe it or not, we're like just 3, maybe 4 Wednesdays away from being done with 1 Samuel, so it'll be time for a party again.
We got back just in time, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So what are you seeing in these chapters? What questions do you have that I may not have covered?
Well, I mean, just to be light about it, David wouldn't have to worry about Saul sitting under a tree holding his spear, would he?
Yeah, I know. I love that, the detail, holding his spear. And he's really, laying the wood to all of his lackeys. And I'm thinking, are they thinking this guy's going to start chucking his spear around, and you're the kind of, nobody's sitting down, you're all on the balls of their feet, they're like, okay, they're doing their head back and forth like a boxer in the ring, like, okay, he's not a good throw, but I'm going to dodge that spear. And then, of course, when he says, kill these priests, and they're like, I mean, that just accentuates their reverence, which then highlights Saul's complete disregard for these sacred men. I mean, that was a gutsy move. I mean, this man is a spear chucker. All right? He's not good. But he can get lucky. And so that was a gutsy move on their part. And it just accentuates how nasty a guy Doeg was. And just the depravity to which Saul had fallen. So, yeah, I love that detail. With his spear in his hand, and it's just like, uh-oh.
It's not better be behind him than in front of him. But that, what I find is so ironic is that he has, 85 priests killed.
Yeah.
So then in verse 21, he says, the Lord bless you for your concerns of me. I mean, in the next chapter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's talk about being out of touch with reality.
These are the people at Ziph. And this is kind of a sub-tribe that lived in Judah. And we don't really know a whole lot about the Ziphites. I think they too also have kind of a onomatopoetic name. But these are people maybe trying to curry favor, or they've been beneficiaries of the status quo and haven't been around Saul enough to realize that he's crazy.
The idea of Saul saying the Lord bless you after he's just had 85 priests bumped off is...
Yeah.
I mean, where's his life in reality?
He's sort of lost touch,
I see.
Reality is a tiny speck in his rearview mirror at this point. And, of course, we have to remember that just as Yahweh is facilitating all of these escapes and victories for David, how Yahweh is building up his legitimacy and popularity among the people, Yahweh has been consistently sending Saul an evil spirit to torment him. I mean, it's arguable that Yahweh drove him crazy on purpose. Perhaps because it was necessary to demonstrate the deep flaws of monarchy. Maybe it was because to accelerate the transition between Saul and David. Maybe it was to ensure that there was not a line of kings established by blood, which was contradictory to all that God had intended when he set this monarchy up in the first place, where he would pick through the prophets, which is how David got chosen by Samuel. So there are lots of different reasons why God might have done that, but it's a bit of a head scratcher. God has Saul chosen. He supports him initially, and Saul makes that one mistake. And it wasn't even really Saul, it was his men who, you know, famished after this battle. Although, remember, they were hungry because Saul wouldn't let them eat before they went into battle. Okay? So really, it's his fault. So they're not eating kosher. And then Saul's answer to that is, well, let me set up an altar. I'll slaughter the animals so the blood can drain out the way it's supposed to. Well, that's not his role. He's not a priest. He's a king. He's blurring the boundaries in a big and bad way. And so that's sort of what triggered this whole, you know, evil spirit. But you could also say that this is simply an outward manifestation of where Saul already was in his head. Because he should have known better. He should have known better than to assume, even in an informal way, the role of a priest. But he did. So you could say that, you know, Saul was kind of skating on the edge even before this evil spirit came. And as we discussed before, this evil spirit was probably the best way that people could have conceptualized of mental illness in the period. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, Jesus's exorcism of demons, and you know, I believe Jesus did exorcise demons, but some of the cases, the symptoms, if you will, that are described of these demon possessed people, really very closely resembles what today we would diagnose as epilepsy, right, which is not a mental illness; it's a neurobiological illness. So,
do we hear any more about Doeg?
I don't think so. I hope not. I fervently hope not.
Unless David gets it.
That would be nice. I can't remember. I can't remember, but let's just hope. Let's hope that we're done with him. He's kind of a bit character, and he's played his role, but
he had a pretty important role.
He did, and you know, you've got this foreigner from Edom doing Saul's dirty work, and it's. Again, it emphasizes, I mean, Saul's closest confidants will not follow his order because they know it's wrong. So now he has to rely on a guy who, you know, isn't part of his people. And, yeah.
So, here's the ephod that's there. It's got these yes and no stones in it, basically. So when David is asking these questions, is he dipping his hand into the ephod and seeing what he pulls out, and that's God's answer? Is that what we assume, that they bring up the ephod?
We're not given a lot of precise information. Presumably there's a pocket. You put the two stones in, you pull one out. But there are other depictions where, because, you know, the ephod also carried 12 stones, one each for the tribes of Israel. And so some of the depictions that you see from the temple period is this pretty heavy breastplate with these 12 stones with the Urim and the Thummim kind of up here. And there's no real clear indication given of how exactly they did this. So we know that, for instance, when Saul was publicly selected as king, and they went through tribe by tribe and family by family and individual by individual, they were using lots. And, you know, and lots usually either is done by the casting of a dice or choosing a stone from... but, yeah, exactly how this worked, we don't know. And, you know, the question here then is, to what extent is David exercising divination? I mean, is he exercising a priestly role? or is it Abiathar bringing the ephod? David's asking the question on his own behalf, and God's responding through the Urim and the Thummim through Abiathar. It's not really clear. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of important, because if it's David who's actually exercising the divination, then that's demonstrating that him blurring the line between someday king and priest is acceptable to God, whereas with Saul it's not, which just increases the sense that David is preferred. There's a sense of mystery around these sacred objects, which I find very appealing. I mean, I'd love to know it, all of it. That's a great question. So we're done with Doeg. Thanks for looking that up. It's always good to have you with your iPad out. I do it too. I mean, just because I'm lazy, you know, I just, you know, pop it in. Like Ben was asking me, which president came after so and so, and I sat there and I scratched my chin for a minute, and I thought, well, if I sit here and think about this long enough, I would know. But I just, like, you know, Google, you know, who is the president after so and so. There you go.
Do you have an Alexa?
No.
Oh.
I love that Super Bowl commercial.
Well, I got one from the kids for Christmas.
You figured out how to turn it on?
Yeah, I got it working pretty well. But I heard there was a young girl, a 7-year-old, who's just started reading, and she's reading quite complicated books. And she'll say to Alexa, what is the meaning of blah, blah, blah? Hmm. So she's... And Alexa will answer.
Wow, a learning tool.
This kid is mm-hmm. learning these words and the meaning of these words just like that, just instantaneously. Wow. While, of course, she can absorb absolutely everything.
Did you guys see the Alexa Super Bowl commercial?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've forgotten.
Yeah, it was. Isn't that awful? In my mind, it was the best of all the Super Bowl commercials. No, I was a little disturbed, frankly, by that commercial.
That was weird.
I just felt like they were trying to borrow his moral authority to sell their trucks. Is what they were trying to do.
Blow as you can get.
No kidding.
And they should have been called out on that. I think they have. Bud, do you want any coffee?
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll be able to hear this. Oh, shoot, I didn't mean to do that. I think I just accidentally turned my phone off. Okay. I just adore this. I mean, Jeff Bezos is in there. The guy from who's really mean in the chef thing, and Anthony Hopkins. So let's see maybe if we can at least hear it. Oh, wait. It's buffering. Joy. Oh, my gosh. It's been viewed 41 million times.
Good Lord.
Three of those are me.
Amazon's Alexa lost her voice this morning.
Alexa lost her voice. How is that even possible?
We have the replacements ready. Just say the word.
You're sure this is going to work?
Yeah.
Alexa, show me a recipe for a grilled cheese sandwich.
I'm pathetic. I'm 32 years of age, and you don't know how to make a grilled cheese sandwich. Its name is the recipe, you...
Alexa, how far is Mars?
Oh, how far is Mars? Well, how am I supposed to know? I've never been there.
Buffering again. All right, now we've lost the volume. Yeah. Oh, come on.
How far is Mars? Well, how am I supposed to know? I've never been there. This guy want to go to Mars. What? There's not even oxygen there.
Alexa, set the mood.
Now setting the mood. You're in the bush. And you're just so dirty. And so sweaty. Because it's hot in that bush.
Alexa, rebush. Reboot.
Alexa, play some country music.
Oh,
I don't dance now. I make money moves.
No, no. Alexa, country music.
Yeah.
so much, I know they tired of me.
What's the call, Brandon?
I'm afraid Brandon is a little tied up.
But do let me know if there's anything I can help you with. Jessica?
So that probably cost what? $5 million?
At least. Oh, at least. Yeah. Well, then you got to pay the make the thing, and you know when you got Anthony Hopkins and a major music star, and gosh, who else they have in it? Or Gordon Ramsay. I just love that. You're 32 years old and you don't know how to make a grilled cheese sandwich. The name is the recipe, you donkey. Okay, break over. Back to Samuel.
Sorry if I'm nominating the question, but how can Jonathan just make a covenant with David, another covenant with David, and then say, but I'm hopping home to my father? I mean, surely he's got to be a little worried that his crazy dad is not going to be too happy.
Yeah, Jonathan's a pretty gutsy guy.
Yeah.
Very selfless. And my, it doesn't tell us why, but my guess is that he's going back to dad to spy on him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really made clear. I mean, in a couple of cases, you know, David, you know, gets some advice from God. But David keeps finding out what Saul's up to. How does he do that? You know, how does he do that? And, you know, maybe, you know, Jonathan's, you know, passing along the information to this, you know, network of people who know how to get to David no matter where he's sitting. And, so it's really a conspiracy with the king's son right at the center of it.
But Saul knows, because none of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me.
Yep.
I mean, he knows that Jonathan's two-timing him.
Yeah, but, you know, it doesn't have to be direct communication. I mean, Saul could try to cut Jonathan out of the loop, but he's still the heir apparent. He's got pull in the king's court. So he could get that from anybody, you know, bribe them, threaten them. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to get information.
But Saul would not kill Jonathan.
Well, I mean, Jonathan does die.
No, but I mean,
in battle,
would Jonathan not be worried that Saul would, you know, fit of temper and?
Well, he's already thrown a spear at Jonathan.
Yeah.
So I mean, Jonathan's got guts. I really admire Jonathan. You know, he's a selfless, courageous, faithful, loving person, and you know, I think he's one of the overlooked heroes of the Bible. And maybe because he's almost too good to be true. You know, I mean, if you were reading 1 Samuel, you'd never read the Bible before. You just decided to start here for whatever reason. I think your suspicion as you move through 1 Samuel is there's some kind of ulterior motive. Jonathan's got something up his sleeve. You know, he's playing everybody for his own benefit because that's just human nature, especially when the stakes are high. Mm-hmm. You know, but it turns out that it's not that way, that this guy is true. He's just true. In fact,
I'd like to have a friend like him.
No kidding. Well, and one of my best friends is named Jonathan, spelled exactly as it's spelled here. And because even David, you know, has demonstrated in his encounter with Abiathar that ends up getting everybody but Abiathar killed, even David has demonstrated that he's a pretty good liar. And he's a sneaky sneaker, you know. He certainly deceived Goliath. You know, he's able to evade Saul consistently.
He's a survivor.
He is. What, do you want to jump into 24? We've got 15 minutes, so actually a little bit more. I think that clock's fast. Emily, check with the authority of all things. Yeah, my iPhone says it's 10:41, so that's fast. So here we go with chapter 24. It's a short one. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to look for David and his men in the direction of the rocks of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds beside the road where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. The men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you." Then David went and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's cloak. Afterward, David was stricken to the heart because he had cut off a corner of Saul's cloak. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to raise my hand against him, for he is the Lord's anointed." So David scolded his men severely and did not permit them to attack Saul. Then Saul got up and left the cave and went on his way. Afterwards, David also rose up and went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord the king!" When Saul looked behind him, David bowed his face to the ground and did obeisance. David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of those who say, 'David seeks to do you harm'? This very day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you into my hand in the cave, and some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not raise my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, the corner of your cloak in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your cloak and did not kill you, you may know for certain that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you are hunting me to take my life. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the ancient proverb says, 'Out of the wicked comes forth wickedness,' but my hand shall not be against you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A single flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you. May he see to it and plead my cause and vindicate me against you." When David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. Today you have explained how you have dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For who has ever found an enemy and sent the enemy safely away? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. Now I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me therefore by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not wipe out my name from my father's house." So David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. Okay. So Saul finds out where David is again. He's got a pretty good informant network too, and he takes a pretty good sized force to try to find him around the rocks of wild goats. And I just haven't done enough study to be able to tell you from memory what this means or where it is. And he's got to go to the bathroom, so he goes into a cave for some privacy, and he ends up going to the cave. We're way back in the back, David and his men are. And his men see this as the work of God. It's like, this is great. You're never going to get a better chance to kill him. So David goes up, and he cuts off a corner of his cloak. You know, and he gets upset with himself, and he feels so guilty because he's like, "Oh, you know, that was a nice cloak, and I've cut off a piece of it." And he goes back to his guys and he says, "Bad, bad boys. You told me to kill him, and that's not right, because God anointed him through Samuel, and he's the rightful king." And then Saul got up and went away. And so He goes out and he calls after Saul, gutsy move, and he goes back and David bows down to him and sort of grovels before him. And he said, you know, why do you believe the people who say that I want to hurt you? Because look at this, I got the corner of your cloak. And if I got close enough to you to slice this off, I could have run you through very easily. Okay? So I had my chance, I didn't take it. And so if I was out to kill you, if I was out to usurp you and claim your throne, then you'd be dead right now. You'd be dead. So God judge between us. And he quotes an ancient proverb. This is the source of which we don't know. You can find stuff similar to this in Psalms and places like Proverbs, whatnot. And then 14 is a little vague. We're not entirely sure what it means. It could be a couple of different things. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A single flea? And this could be David sort of putting himself down. Why are you worried about me? Because compared to you, I'm like a single flea. I mean, this is silly for you to be chasing me around. Because remember, David's got around 400 to 600 men, and Saul's coming down with 3,000. So, I mean, grotesquely outnumbered. And or it could be mocking Saul, you know. It could be both at once. And David's basically saying, God decide between us. And so Saul says, David, is it you? And it's almost like he can't believe it. And he starts crying. And he says, David, you know, you could have killed me and you didn't. And I've been trying to kill you really hard. So you're better than me. You know, this is just an extremely rare occurrence. I mean, if you've got an enemy and you have a chance to kill them, you kill them, and you didn't. You let me, you know, just walk out of that cave. And so, God bless you. God reward you with good. And now I know that you shall surely be king. So, this is the first time that Saul's able to articulate his deepest fear that David will succeed him. And all he asks is that, don't wipe out my house when you become king. David, you know, swears to that effect. Saul goes home, but David doesn't go with him. Remembering all too well the two times that Saul tried to spear him against the wall, he and his men keep their distance. They go back to their stronghold. And that's going to set up some things to come. There's a unusual narrative in chapter 25, which is almost really an interruption of the overall narrative, and that's part of the sewing together of multiple traditions. I mean, it's not insignificant, but it sort of is, you know, interruptive, and you get into 26 and you see that this reconciliation, as has happened before, literally in a matter of verses, the Ziphites. Maybe Ziphite means snitch in Hebrew, I'm not really sure. But they come to him and say, hey, we know where David is, and he goes with 3,000 men again to seek him out. So, you know, Saul is just all over the place. I mean, he's all over the map in both senses of the word. And, you know, it's a little repetitive, but it's kind of getting fun. And no more spoilers for the chapters ahead. So anything in 24 that sort of piques your interest? I mean, maybe you know about the rocks or the wild goats or, you know, the variety. I know Paul's looking online or, you know, what this dead dog single flea business is.
Yeah, that must have some kind of story to it that they were familiar with.
Yeah, and, it could be kind of a euphemism, you know, or a slang type of expression that we no longer know what the meaning of that is. But I'll, you know, consult the commentaries. But my guess is, I'm reading along, I'm going to get to that, and it's going to be basically a verbal shoulder shrug, as you often find in a book like this.
Well, the interesting and unbelievable part is how he could cut off a piece, be that close to him.
That's impressive.
Not be discovered.
I mean, it must have been a very sharp sword.
Must have been a long relief, too.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Golly. And loud.
Yeah, it's just, it's really comical how some of this stuff is set up. And, why couldn't he go into the cave to get into the shade? He certainly has a fondness for tamarisk trees.
Saul's got 3,000 men, and David's in this cave and comes out of the cave with 400.
Yeah.
If Saul's serious about bumping off David, why doesn't he just turn around and he's got him in the cave and he's on the ground in front of him?
Well, because he knows full well, I can sort of see David dangling this piece of cloak, and then, Saul's like, oh man, the corner of my cloak's gone. And so he knows that he is alive only because David has permitted it. And so he basically thanks him for it, and he says, I had you all wrong, you're a good guy, you're on my side, obviously, or I'd be dead. And but the question is, did he really mean it?
Yeah. No.
Was he just kind of playing for time? Was he trying to skate over a really embarrassing situation where he had made himself incredibly vulnerable, and David had shown a great act of mercy, which would have only made Saul and his vindictiveness appear in a worse light? And but I just think that Saul, he was completely uncentered. Mm-hmm. And I think that he was sincere. It says that he wept, you are more righteous than I. I think he really meant it. But, 2 hours later, he was probably somewhere else in his head. And we know people like that. There are people in our lives that you encounter, and on a day-to-day basis, you just don't know. Is this person going to be nice? Are they going to be argumentative? Are they going to be, critical? Are they going to say something ugly, nasty? There are people like this who, they're just all over the place, and they're unpredictable, and you never know. And I think Saul is that person.
Well, remind me again, are there other historical references that we can really sort of believe these small stories within the big story?
No.
So these could be somebody's, maybe part of it is a little exaggeration.
It's
hyperbole.
The sources of these stories, the biblical stories, come from a mix of fragmentary written and oral traditions, as just about everything did this far back. In extra-biblical historical sources, and remember, in this era, historical kind of needs to be in quotation marks. They didn't write history the way we write history, with extensive research and footnotes, in part because they didn't have big libraries. We're going to check this out. In the grander scheme of things, what's going on in Israel is not a big deal. They're not a big power player, and neither are any of their neighbors. Egypt is the major regional power during this time. And so, it's kind of like, and I don't mean to derogate anybody, but right now you're going to find a lot more news stories about what's going on in the United States than you find in terms of what's going on politically and economically and culturally in Panama.
Yes, exactly.
Okay? So we have very little in the way of archaeological evidence or extra-biblical written sources about any of this. Well, it is actually now 11 o'clock. We covered 3 chapters in one day. That's a record. That's a record for this group. I will do a little more research just on some of these little peculiar details, but then we will plunge into the next 2 chapters, and maybe that will get us... What is today? Is it the 7th? So that means by the time we finish with 1 Samuel, we'll be in Lent. So we'll have to have, I don't know, a barley cake and sour wine celebration once we finish with 1 Samuel. So.